Hello, can I speak to Peter Sandman, please?
Yes, this is he.
Hi, Peter. It's Maura O'Malley here from Intellectual Property Magazine.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Hi. Is now a good time to talk? Or?
Now is just fine.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thanks again for your prompt response. Appreciate it. Just to kind of give you an idea of what I'm trying to kind of cover in the article, it's just all about, I suppose, trying to focus on the online management of your reputation with the explosion of social media, blogs and platforms.
Uh-huh.
Just get sort of straight into it, I guess. How do you think the growth of the internet and social media blogs has affected the way people deal with criticism, managing their reputation? How has it affected reputation management?
Well, the existence of social media and the popularity of social media has pretty obviously made it much easier for an outlier, an individual with a grievance or an axe to grind or a genuine problem to get lots of attention and to find other people who have the same problem or who respond, who resonate to the problem that person is raising. That all used to be very hard to do. If you were an individual and an airline or a multinational corporation did something that offended you, there were real, limits on your ability prior to the social media, to raise hell. Unless you were a professional activist or really wanted to, devote your life to it. I mean, there have always been people long before social media who, would experience some moment of impact, who would suddenly get very angry and very upset, very outraged at something some organization did and spend the rest of their lives getting even. Slowly putting together an activist group or writing endless letters to regulators and eventually getting action. I mean, such people always existed. But you had to be obsessed. If you weren't obsessed, there wasn't a lot you could do.
Yes.
Now it's a piece of cake, to post a blog or put a video on YouTube or whatever. So that, what used to be events so minor that companies judged there was no need to take them seriously are no longer minor. Now, I think that's mostly a good effect. It's good for the society, but it's also good for big organizations because it is teaching them something they should have known without social media, which is that individual unhappy customers or unhappy stakeholders are important.
Yes.
The individual unhappy stakeholder used to be the tip of the iceberg, and companies would ignore them until they hit the iceberg. Now, it's as if the iceberg had a neon sign on its tip.
Yes.
So I think companies are slowly learning, and government agencies too. I don't mean to say just companies.
Yeah.
All big organizations are slowly learning to be more responsive earlier.
Yes.
Which is a good thing. It's good for their reputations. I know everybody experiences this as a reputational threat. But what it really is a reputational benefit because you're getting much earlier warning of the reputational threat. You're getting to see it as a threat earlier and address it more productively.
Yes, and I mean go on. Go on. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, yes. I suppose risk management and sort of dealing with crises. I mean, the internet must have totally changed the way sort of you deal with crisis management, say compared to 20 years ago even. It's how quickly things have seemed to have changed and the way companies and government agencies you were saying must respond to stories and things like that.
I don't think the change is that spectacular. I mean, the main change is the one we've been talking about. Everything is speeded up.
Yeah.
And the distinction between a small local problem and a big national or international problem is no longer a very meaningful distinction.
Yes, yeah.
You know, small local problems are now big national and international problems, you know, within minutes.
Yeah.
Those are important changes, but they're not changes in how you handle a crisis. They're just changes in how quickly you have to handle a crisis and in what gets called a crisis.
Yes.
Things you used to be able to shrug off, and
yeah.
as I've tried to argue, were unwise to shrug off.
Yes.
Now it's obvious that you can't shrug off.
So there's still, I suppose, elements of risk management that will always sort of stay the same, crisis management that will always stay the same no matter what is happening in multimedia and things like that. And
I think there's much more that's stable than there is that's changed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What remains stable is, you know, when people are upset, they want their concerns addressed. Not ignored.
Mm.
They want them addressed empathically, not contemptuously.
Yes.
They're more interested in how they're communicated with than they are in the actual solution.
Yeah.
That is, you know, in all but the most dire threats. I mean, you know, when the threat is really dire, you care about your life being saved more than you care about being talked to well.
Yeah. I know what you mean. There's a difference. You have to qualify there.
That's right. But in most normal situations where people are angry or frightened, how you talk to them matters more than whether you're able to actually solve the problem.
Mm.
All those things have been true forever. And I don't think the internet has changed them at all. I don't think social media has changed them at all.
And as you were, I just had a quick read of some of the articles. People just really want to vent, don't they? Once they've vented, a lot of the anger is just dissipated, isn't it? And they're kind of
They want to vent in front of each other, which the internet facilitates.
Mm.
They want to vent in front of you, which the internet facilitates if you let it. That is, if you're responsive, if you show that you're there, and they want to vent in front of the media, that's the one that hasn't, that's hardest, and the internet hasn't helped that much. I mean, it's not as if when you put something on your blog, it winds up in the mainstream media. It may or may not wind up in the mainstream media, but you have a replacement for the media that enables you to vent in front of your peers. And ideally in front of your target, in front of the people who are upset with you.
Mm.
Now, what's stunning to me and maybe interesting, for your article, is a lot of my clients follow criticism of their organizations in the social media very carefully while pretending not to.
Okay.
They are in fact,
Lurkers.
Reading the critics' blogs.
Yeah.
If there's an article that's, if there's a website called xyzcorpsucks.com,
they'll be on it.
Yeah, but they use anonymizers, so they're on it without the critics knowing they're on it,
and they never
comment on it.
Yeah.
They never comment about it, but they certainly, even if they're going to comment about it, they don't actually comment on it.
Yes.
And they pretend it doesn't exist while taking it very seriously. They pretend they're not taking it seriously. That's really stupid.
Right, yes. Yeah.
it's very common, but it's
sort of human nature to a certain extent, kind of sort of to acknowledge it. Maybe they imagine it gives it a certain amount of credibility.
Well, that's what they imagine is they don't want to dignify their critics with a response.
Yes, yeah.
But because the tech specs for venting, I mean, the thing that makes venting reduce outrage requires that you're not venting in a closet. You're venting in front of the people, both your peers, the people who may share your anger, but also the people you're angry at.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to vent my anger and get calm, what you need to do is notice that I'm angry, let me see that you've noticed that I'm angry, and then respond in a way that's empathic.
Yeah. Yes.
And if you, if you didn't see it, you know, all right, you didn't see it.
Yes.
But if you saw it and pretended you weren't looking,
yes.
That's stupid.
Yeah. I mean, and then that kind of brings me on to my next question, which you're kind of answering, is how do companies, how should they deal with online criticism, whether that be on blogs, YouTube, or discussion forums, and as you were saying, try to acknowledge it first of all. Would that be it? Don't sort of bury your head in the sand about it, or
yeah. I mean, my judgment would be that all organizations should try to look as responsive as they can to criticism.
Yeah,
and they should at least try to look as responsive as they actually are.
Mm.
You know,
should all be pretend. Yes.
So, what that means is be willing to comment on your critics' blogs and websites and whatnot. Be willing, you know, to tweet back if they tweet about you. Be willing to acknowledge that they're right when they're right. And be suitably apologetic. Try to make it right, but making it right isn't as important as publicly acknowledging that something got screwed up.
Yeah.
Be respectful in pointing out the ways in which they're wrong when they're wrong. Put more emphasis on the ways in which they're right. I mean,
yeah.
I routinely say to clients, you know, look for the aspects of criticism you can validate.
Yes.
You know, and validate them. Don't validate criticisms that are false in your judgment, but don't start by rebutting other people's crap. Start by validating their valid objections.
Mm. It's a real diffuser, that, isn't it? They've acknowledged that, and it just sort of a lot of the anger, I think, you know, melts away, doesn't it? I think, and
yeah, not always, but it certainly makes the anger worse to feel like you're being ignored. And it often makes the anger considerably less to feel like you're being heard and taken seriously and treated respectfully.
Yeah.
And third parties, I mean, the people, you know, now that all of that was always true. Okay?
Mm.
But now, you know, if I'm angry at your corporation and I've posted something on a blog somewhere to express my anger at your corporation, there are hundreds or thousands or even millions of people watching who aren't especially angry. They didn't go through whatever I went through. They're interested.
Mm.
And when you're dealing with me, you know, you're not just dealing with me. It's not even, you know, you're not most importantly dealing with me. You're most importantly dealing with the people who are watching you deal with me.
So the question
is, if your company has behaved in a way that I found offensive, you know, independent of whether you think I'm crazy or you think I'm right, independent of whether you're feeling apologetic or you're feeling, abused by me, the important question is, how do you want the people, the third parties, the people who are watching this dialogue, how do you want them to see you respond?
Yeah.
Do they want to see you being defensive? Do they want to see you? Do you want them to see you being dismissive, or do you want them to see you being responsive?
Mm.
There's a seesaw at work here.
Mm.
Let's assume my criticism isn't valid. Or at least it's exaggerated. I'm going off the deep end about what should have been a minor problem, and I'm exploding it all out of proportion. Let's just assume for the moment that's true, and my anger at you is unjustified, or at least is excessive. Now, if you are, if you're pointing out endlessly that I'm being excessive and that I'm a nutter, then the third parties watching begin to see me as more in the right.
Yes.
If, on the other hand, you're responsive And, you know, you're saying, gee, I'm really sorry, and I'm saying, that's not good enough, you have to do this. And you
yeah,
say,
then
no.
The other party begins to lose face and look unreasonable, I guess. And
that's right. And everybody, you know, we all start rolling our eyes.
Yeah.
If, you know, if you roll your eyes at crazy people, then they look to the rest of the world like whistleblowers.
Yeah.
If you are responsive to them, the rest of the world can roll our eyes and,
yeah.
and think, you know, why are you bending over backwards to be so responsive to this jerk? You have to be the last one to think this person is a jerk.
Yes.
That was always true yeah. at public meetings. It was always true at, like, AGMs. At shareholder meetings.
Mm.
It was always true, you know, with letters to the editor.
Mm.
But it used to be that most individuals who were angry at you, if you dealt with them at all, you dealt with them alone. They wrote you a letter and you
okay.
wrote an answer. Now you have an audience.
Yeah.
And how that audience sees you responding is much more important than whether you wind up satisfying the critic.
Yeah, definitely. And do you have, I've just been sort of doing a little bit of Google research about it, and people, how do you think you should manage sort of your reputation online? Do you believe in sort of kind of this continuous monitoring of, you know, of Google alerts and, I've got a number of those, Technocrati, which tracks buzz in the blogosphere. I mean, do you advise clients to do that kind of thing, or?
The important phrase is that kind of thing. I'm not a technology expert,
yeah.
So I'm not in a position to tell clients here's a good way to monitor how you're seen on the
mm-hmm.
the web, and here's
yeah.
the less good way. I don't know what the good ways are,
yeah.
And you know, my clients have people, you know, on staff who are 30 years younger than I am and understand that stuff a lot better than I ever
do
will.
Do I need to find someone that understands that sort of thing?
You know, so I have no expertise
on
how to monitor, you know, what the right ways
are of monitoring
your reputation on the social media.
It appears to be that kind of thing, I think. But, yeah, maybe I should try kind of get a bit more detail on the little kind of little monitoring sort of tools. I suppose, do clients come to you when they've spotted something and it's about to get out of control and they're worried, and do they come to you when things got really bad,
often? I mean,
yeah.
I have some clients that have worked with me before and, you know, come to me earlier or sort of keep me around looking over their shoulder, but the first time a client comes to me is always when they're in deep shit.
The monitoring stage.
That's right.
And
it may not have started in social media. I mean, remember that social media are not just a place where problems originate.
Oh, yes,
they're also a place where problems echo.
Yeah.
If you've got a factory in a town in Madagascar. And you're having a quarrel with the townspeople. Your factory management is having a quarrel with the townspeople because they think you promised to hire a lot of locals, and instead of hiring locals, you're bringing in expats. And they're not getting the jobs they thought they were getting, and they're angry.
How do you deal with that?
That's not a social media problem. That's a local problem.
But it could be picked up, though.
Exactly. That town in Madagascar is going to create a website. And critics of your company in Bolivia are going to notice that website because they're monitoring, you know. They're looking every day for criticisms of your company just like you are.
Mm.
Your critics are looking for your other critics.
Mm.
So your plant manager in Bolivia comes into the office and is dealing with a Bolivian issue, and the Bolivian community group says, well, why should we trust you? Look what you did to those people in Madagascar.
Yeah.
And the plant manager in Bolivia is thinking, I don't even know where Madagascar is. You know, what are they talking about? As a result, and this isn't even social media, this is just, you know, the web itself, you know, as a result of the existence of the web, NGOs have globalized better than multinational corporations.
So the
plant manager in Bolivia has very little contact with the plant manager in Madagascar, even though they work for the same company.
Yeah.
But the activist group in Madagascar and the activist group in Bolivia are likely to be talking to each other across language barriers within days.
Yeah,
you know, they're sending emails back and forth, they're cross-posting web content and so forth.
Yeah, that the NGOs have been very quick. The click activists are, activists have really sort of embraced online technology, haven't they? More so, as you were saying, the multinational corporations. I mean, your clients, obviously, I know you don't want to sort of reveal details, but is any of them kind of legal law firms, or is any of them with any kind of legal, sort of a legal slant, or?
Occasionally, but I mean, my main interest is the management of what I call outrage. You know, Matt. You know, getting people more upset when a risk is serious and they're not taking it seriously enough. Getting people less upset when a risk isn't serious and they're blowing it out of proportion. It's not rare for that to turn out to be a legal battle as well. You know, that you know, people are suing you because they think you gave them cancer or whatever. But I would say maybe 20% of my client base comes to me through their attorneys. And 80% come to me through their communication people.
I suppose our readership would be in-house counsel in their corporate lawyers in these corporations.
Happy to have them become clients. But my contact with corporate counsel is usually comes the other way. That is, you know, the communication people or the operations people or the CEO bring me in and say, you know, we're hemorrhaging reputation. What can we do? And I say, you know, and I look at the situation and I say, well, I think you need to do X and Y and Z. And then some attorney says, no, you can't do those. That would damage our litigation position. Most of my contact, not all by any means, but a lot of my contact with the company's attorneys comes not because the attorney has asked for my advice on how to manage a legal controversy, but because the company has asked my advice on how to manage a controversy that is outside the courts. And the lawyers are worried that the strategies I'm recommending might do harm to some, you know, either ongoing or potential legal battle.
Okay. So that your advice might somehow sort of weaken a litigation that ended up in court, for instance.
Yeah.
Admitting a problem, say, for instance, might weaken their case if it ever goes to court.
Exactly. Or they're worried that it might. There's an article on my website called Lawyers and Risk Communication that you might want to look at.
Yeah. Okay.
That talks about that, but I mean,
what would you say to that though? When you get this quite relatively common complaint from lawyers that are saying, "Oh, we don't want to admit anything, just in case that comes in."
Two dominant answers. The first answer is, you know, we can always, if we work together, find a compromise. That is, I'm looking for ways to protect reputation, and you're looking for ways to protect liability. If we work together, we can come up with strategies that are legally sound and reputationally sound.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
The classic example, interestingly enough, is an example from BP.
I've just been thinking about them in my head as an example of something that was hemorrhaging reputation.
Exactly. BP had an earlier spill in 1990.
Yeah.
From a tanker, and it wasn't their tanker. The spill was in Huntington Beach, California, and as the CEO was flying to the scene of the spill, his lawyers were saying, "Look,
don't
admit responsibility. Yeah. It's not our tanker. We have a defense. We're going to argue that the son of a bitch spilled our oil." And the communication people on the plane were saying, you know, come on, it's our oil. It was on its way from our oil well to our oil refinery. We hired the tanker company. If we don't take moral responsibility for the spill, the public outrage is going to go ballistic. So what the CEO had to do is find a way to take moral responsibility without taking legal responsibility.
How do you do that?
It wasn't hard. He landed in Huntington Beach. He held a news conference.
Yeah.
A reporter asked the key question, and the question was planted because we wanted it asked. And the question was, "Do you consider this spill your company's fault?"
Oh.
And here's the answer. This is what he said. Our lawyers tell us it's not our fault legally, but we feel like it's our fault,
right.
And we're going to act like it's our fault.
That's very good.
That's a spectacular answer. The lawyers went home saying, thank God he said it's not our fault. He protected his company's defense. But 80 million people heard that soundbite on television and said to themselves, I can't believe the CEO of an oil company has taken moral responsibility for its spill.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, 20, this, that was in 1990. 20 years later, BP had the spill at Deepwater Horizon, the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and they did exactly the opposite. In 1990, they took moral responsibility without taking legal responsibility. In 2010, they took legal responsibility without taking moral responsibility.
Yeah.
One worked fine, and the other has been disastrous.
You
can usually, remember I said there were two things, so this is all the first one.
This is the compromise.
You can usually find a compromise that protects your legal position and still takes an appropriate reputational position, which is usually some kind of apology, some kind of acknowledgement that you messed up. That's the first half of the answer. The second half of the answer is that there are a lot of legal benefits that lawyers are inattentive to that come from reducing outrage, that come from calming people down. People, for the most part, do not file lawsuits. They don't litigate in order to get rich. Lawyers litigate in order to get rich, but plaintiffs litigate in order to get even. If you look at toxic tort litigation or medical malpractice litigation or, pretty much any area of tort law, most of the plaintiffs are experiencing much more outrage than greed. If you interview plaintiffs on the day they go to trial and you say, what's uppermost in your mind, they don't say, I hope I get enough money to retire in Tahiti. The most common comment plaintiffs make on the day they go to trial is the son of a bitch never even apologized. So the evidence is very strong, and a lot of lawyers are beginning to acknowledge this. The evidence is very strong that if you do good outrage management, good reputation management, you have fewer suits to defend. Because fewer people want to sue you. If you're in the U.S., where punitive damages are the big deal, you're also protecting yourself against punitives. If you're apologetic, punitive damages come off the table. Punitive damages are precisely punishment because you're not sorry enough. So if you are sorry enough, the punitives come off the table. But even long before you get to court, in terms of how many people sue or how many people sign on to a class action, I have a client that I can't name that emitted, decades ago, emitted a lot of dioxin. They didn't even know it. They should have known, but they didn't know. They emitted a lot of dioxin. It went out their stacks. It wound up in the local soil and in the local rivers and creeks and lakes. And they're extremely vulnerable both tort litigation and regulatory litigation, and I have been working with them for several years on diminishing people's incentive, or incentive is the wrong word, diminishing people's motive to want to sue them.
Yes.
By being apologetic and by being honest, and in a variety of ways, all of which the lawyers have had grave reservations about.
Right.
And this has been going on for some years, and plaintiff's attorneys keep coming into town, walking around, and leaving town because nobody seems to want to sue.
Do you think there is that kind of shift away amongst sort of legal experts that by, as you were saying, reducing outrage defense?
The smart lawyers are noticing it. It's moved further in some areas than in other areas. When I was a young man and I first got my driver's license, I remember auto insurance companies used to say, if you're in an accident, the only thing you are to communicate to the other party to the accident is your name, your address.
Yes, that's what you're told, aren't you? Yeah.
Don't say you're sorry. And they don't say that anymore. Now they say, feel free to be apologetic and try to be friendly with the other person so that there's less likely to be a lawsuit. That's a real change.
That is, it's a shift. It's just, particularly in the U.S. where it has that sort of more sort of, the litigious culture is a little bit more prevalent. And
yes. Same thing has happened with medical malpractice. Doctors used to be told, never say you're sorry. And now they're told, you can prevent more lawsuits if you're apologetic.
Yeah.
If you go to the patient or the patient's family and you say, I feel awful about the way things turned out.
Yeah. It's simple. It's psychology, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just bringing a bit of human nature back into the whole sort of process, isn't it?
It's partly a matter of incentives. I mean, let's do some math here. Okay, let's assume that if you are defensive and intransigent and silent about a particular issue, you will be sued 20 times. There'll be 20 lawsuits, and you'll win 10 of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's assume that if you do good outrage management, if you're apologetic and so forth, you're a whole lot less likely to be sued. There'll be only 10 lawsuits instead of 20.
Right.
But you've given away a certain amount of ammunition in the process of being apologetic.
Yeah.
So let's say you'll win 3 of them.
Right.
Okay. So you're going to win 3 out of 10 instead of winning 10 out of 20.
Okay.
Now, from the company's point of view, winning 3 out of 10 is better than winning 10 out of 20. You lost 7 case suits instead of 10.
Yes.
But from the lawyer's point of view, your one loss average is a lot better and your office is a lot busier if you win 7 out of 10 than 3 than 7 10 out of 20 than 3 out of 10. So the lawyer has an incentive to have lots of suits that you win. But the company's incentive isn't about the percentage of cases you win, it's about the number of cases you lose.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, they're coming from sort of two different sort of angles, the corporations and the lawyers.
So lawyers give advice that makes them likelier to win the case, and I give them advice that makes them less likely to have to litigate the case at all.
Yeah, it's quite an important difference to bring out. This is sort of fascinating. I feel like we could talk about this forever. Is there anything else do you think I should sort of be bringing up that you think I've missed here, or you've given me a lot of sort of fascinating detail, actually. You're the first person I've spoken to about this, so I think you're giving me a nice overview as well.
I don't know. I mean, probably.
I need to talk to someone about the tools, how to actually track your sort of your reputation online.
Yes, I have no expertise there at all.
No, that's fine.
I will emphasize something that, one of the articles I referred you to talks about, but I don't know if you got to it. I think it's really important, and this is not particularly about social media, this is just about reputation generally. It's really important for organizations to understand that good reputation and bad reputation are independent.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of my clients imagine that, you know, it's like a bank account, and, you know, if somebody hates you, you know, I mean, if you've done something that generated outrage, you can get back to where you started by doing something that makes people like you.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't work that way.
No.
How much you're loved and how much you're hated are uncorrelated variables. They have almost no relationship to each other. And how much, they're both important, but how much you're hated is a lot more important. So, routinely say to clients, you're focusing too much on cultivating love and too little on alleviating hate.
Yeah.
And you're imagining that they're the same thing, but, you know, they're not.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. When you think how much people love Apple, or, won't you, that's quite a polarizing thing these days. Or they used to love Google, and now they don't really love Google so much anymore because it's so powerful. It's funny how it shifts as well, depending on...
Yeah, and, you know, and there are a lot of organizations that, you know, that are, and I think Apple and Google are probably among them, whose positives and negatives are both high. You know, the classic example is Walmart. You know, at least in the U.S., Walmart is intensely loved and intensely hated. And you know, of course, that's characteristic of lots of politicians who are intensely loved and intensely hated.
They're polarizing characters. Do you think
that's right?
Yeah, either love them or you hate them, I guess, to a certain extent.
Yeah, so there are two completely independent tasks. You know, one to try to get more people to love you, and a quite different task to try to get fewer people to hate you. And my clients confuse those tasks.
And of course.
Working on love is much more fun than working on
hate. I know, I can imagine.
More fun to sponsor philanthropies than apologize to victims.
Yeah.
You know, but sponsoring philanthropies does not reduce the outrage of victims.
No.
You know, so clients sort of systematically, companies systematically, and government agencies also, systematically focus on What are some good things I can do that will make people like me better? And they really don't want to do the things that will make the people who are very upset with me less upset.
Yeah. Exactly. They want to focus on sort of corporate social responsibility. God, that mouthful that I'm hearing a lot about and been seen to be, yeah. Definitely, yeah. I'm definitely going to point out that the two of them are independent and not linked. Not, you know, just because you're more loved doesn't mean you're less hated and things like that. But that's brilliant, Peter. Unless there's anything else, if I think of anything else, it'd be okay to drop you an email or clarify any of the points. Or
that's fine.
Yeah, that's great.
Fine. If you wind up using what you know this interview in whatever you write, I am happy to look at it.
Sure, I might
comment on it. If you don't want me to, I don't care.
Okay.
Now, what I do care about is I want
the
MP3.
I'll show you a PDF of the article, and you'll get a few copies of the magazine as well.
Excellent.
And
you will email me this conversation.
The MP3. I will. Yeah, I record all my interviews anyway, just to make sure everything's just as accurate as possible and things like that. So.
Excellent. Well, I may or may not do anything with my copy of the tape, but independent of that, if you want me to sort of elaborate on points, an efficient way to do that is to send me a draft of the article, and it may or may not provoke me to make some additional comments.
Yeah, definitely I will. And yeah, I'll send you the MP3 player afterwards. And if you do put it on your website, can you just let us know and just make sure you mention Intellectual Property Magazine? Peter was talk. Here is an interview with Peter.
Send me the MP3 as quickly, within the next day or
so. I'll do that now. Sure.
And as you do that, tell me what you want me to put on the website, and I'll, if I use it at all, I'll put exactly what you tell me.
All right, great. Yeah, I'll just double check with the editor, actually. She doesn't today, but yeah, I'll send it probably then tomorrow, the next day. That's okay. Okay. Thanks. Okay. Thanks very much, Peter.
My pleasure.
No, it's fascinating.
Good luck with the article. It's an interesting topic.
I know, it is. The more and more I'm researching about it, actually, the more I'm kind of getting into it. And
yeah, it sounds like you're having fun.
Yeah. No, it's good. Okay. Thanks, Peter.
My pleasure. Take
bye.
Care.
Bye. See you. Bye.